From Xi'an, China, I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I are in China this week and share our observations about a growing, energy-hungry, environmentally concerning country.
We sat along the river in Shanghai and could barely see across as the smog just sat there, hung over these beautiful new buildings.
And later, my conversation with environmental scientist Earl Ellis. He spent 4 years studying how China's rural agricultural villages used easy-to-obtain synthetic nitrogen.
How does that affect the rest of the planet? And it does. You know, you see big changes in soils, crop yields, populations, all these things change when you change the nitrogen cycle.
The impact of humans on global ecosystems. After this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Rebecca Cruz, here we are in Xi'an, China. This is our third city on a four-city tour. We've been to Shanghai, Nanjing, and now we're in Xi'an. And wow, what an amazing country. This is an incredible place. It's very clear that this country is on the move. Big news since we arrived, or really right before we arrived a few days ago, is that at the New Year, a deal signed last year with Russia to export Russian oil, crude oil, to China began on the 1st of January. And so you can tell this place is major. There's a major demand for energy here. Everything's lit up. Everything's running, lots of cars, people going everywhere. So you can tell there's a huge demand for energy, and this is going to make a huge impact, this deal with Russia.
Well, I think that's the first thing that I noticed coming to China. You had obviously been here before 6 years ago, but you just noticed the large amount of people. There are people everywhere, and this is a country that has developed very quickly over about the last 30 or so years on an export-led plan, and so we have a rising middle class as well. So these are people that want to have nice things, they want to have electricity, they want to have cars, and all of that takes energy. So this trade with Russia is very, very important. You mentioned crude oil. There's also plans in the work for more natural gas. There's also kind of a political thing going on here, of course, as we see Russia getting closer and closer to China. And we also saw here recently Ukraine now negotiating some similar policies with China. So a real, real need for energy. And we've seen it. We sat along the river in Shanghai and could barely see across as the smog just sat there, hung over these beautiful new buildings. And then we also saw up the river the coal that was going, and you could smell it and you could feel it in your lungs. And, quite honestly, there's been a lot of coughing. So it's been quite the experience.
Yeah, definitely. Even though we're talking about oil and gas, coal is still a major source of energy here in China. And we saw barge after barge after barge of coal going down the river in Shanghai to serve their energy needs. Well, of course, this is all related then, as you mentioned, to the smog, and that is the environmental issues here in China. And that is the next thing I would say that is very evident is when you arrive in China is the air quality or the lack of air quality. And so clearly seeing the power plants, seeing the factories, and the air is just unbelievably thick and dense, full of pollution because of that the coal burning and the other types of energy production they have going on.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that, as I mentioned, that's really driving this is consumerism, that the people are able to have more and they want more. And this has been very smart in some ways in the Chinese government. They still are technically a communist country, but they've liberalized their economies a great deal. And I think we've seen some of that people are consuming. They want to have things. They want to have nice things. There's all sorts of stores, many of them Western, and they seem to be doing good trade. And at the same time, there are these kind of underlining things that you might not see. I think we would both agree that there's kind of another factor going on here, some restrictions. We've had trouble getting on the internet, finding anything about China that is even could be construed as negative. Although we've been able to get onto to Facebook, you know, social media seems to be monitored in some regard as well. We've heard about, you know, forced retirement rates or other interesting policies that really do remind us that there is a great deal of government control here, despite all of the consumerism. And perhaps the consumerism is allowing people to not pay quite as much attention to the control that they are under.
Of course, it's not Chinese consumerism. It's consumerism around the world. Everybody around the world is consuming Chinese products, and it's all being made right here in front of us. It's so interesting to see all of the things that we purchase at home, of course, are being made right here, and then we're seeing them on the shelves here in China as well. And the Chinese are just eating it up, if you will. And not to mention that, they're eating up McDonald's and Starbucks and Pizza Hut and all the stuff that we see on every single street corner. But there is. There's this underlying other kind of China going on. I mean, you see that the economic side of it, the tremendous growth. I mean, you really never know, being in the east coast of China, that you're in a relatively poor country, again, relatively speaking. But then you look at the fact that we have a hard time reading and understanding much about what's going on in China here politically. And people don't really sit around and have political conversations. You know, we had some conversations while we were here about social services and social programs and things like maternity leave and child care and women in society. And we heard, you know, how expensive it is and more expensive to live in China and to own an apartment. And so there is some underlying other stuff going on, and we really don't see it on the surface at all.
No, we don't. And as there's, you know, there has been some growth in the Chinese economy, and that's to be expected. But there seem to be some little hints that the economy may be beginning to start to falter. So we might see some breaks in the system, probably not in the immediate, but perhaps down the road, some things may be changing.
Definitely an interesting country to watch in the future. Well, we're on to our next assignment. After we go to Beijing, we are on to Dubai. So stay tuned. We'll be reporting from Dubai next week. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you may have. You can leave a comment in the Worldviews section of our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. And at Suzette Gorlot, and at Cruise226. Coming up, I'll talk with Earl Ellis. He's an environmental scientist at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and studies the effects of humans on the ecology of landscapes. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. My guest, Earl Ellis, is an environmental scientist at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He studies global ecology and the history of human landscapes. In the mid-90s, he examined how rural China's change from traditional to industrial agriculture affected the landscape's nitrogen cycle. Earl Ellis, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
So, Earl, you're doing some very interesting research that investigates the ecology of anthropogenic landscapes and their changes at local to global scales. What does that mean? Can you tell us a little bit more about what anthropogenic landscape is?
So, in a nutshell, an anthropogenic landscape is a landscape that has been formed by human activity, usually over a significant period of time. So the ecologies of a place like this, and I think they're all around us, so we're all familiar with them, are profoundly different than what you'd find before humans start interacting by using agriculture, building settlements, hunting, all sorts of human activities that change the ecology of landscapes. And as these have become more and more extensive across the world, the best estimate I have is about 3/4 of Earth's land is in this category, we are looking at a globally significant ecological pattern. The anthropogenic landscape is inherently global at this time.
So obviously the connection between humans and their environment or the landscape that they're using. So everything from the way in which we alter the landscape to build buildings, to farm, to build homes, to make lawns, all of that is what you're talking about in terms of how we alter the world in which we're living from its natural state to something that is friendly to humans or preferable to humans?
Well, sometimes it's preferable to humans. I think that's the intention. Sometimes what we create, we're not very fond of. And you can imagine some kinds of ecosystems full of invasive species or species invasions, I should say, that we're not so happy with that are also caused by us. But the bottom line is you can't really imagine these ecologies occurring without us. They're inherently human ecology.
So you're not really talking about things like climate change or, you know, the result the longer term result of human interaction with the environment, or are you? Is that a distant connection to what you're talking about here in terms of anthropogenic landscapes?
So my research focuses primarily on what I would call direct human interaction with landscapes and ecosystems. So that doesn't include climate change, which is an indirect effect, you know, how humans alter climate and then climate alters ecosystems. And the reality is that terrestrial ecosystems on land have been interacting with changing climates for as long as there's been life on land. So that's not really a new thing. The rate of climate change now is novel and unprecedented, most likely. But it's not that unusual for ecosystems to be adapting to changing climates. But some of the other things that humans do to ecosystems on land are fairly novel, such as tillage and the formation of agricultural ecosystems, human settlements. These are all relatively novel ecosystems.
Particularly in like mass quantities in terms of like urbanization, right? So how is it that, you know, a growing kind of urban world where people are moving off of that kind of natural landscape into cities, is that something that you're looking at all? And what is the impact of that, I guess, or the implications of urbanization?
Ah, great question. And the most fascinating thing about what urbanization is doing to anthropogenic landscapes, and when we say anthropogenic landscapes, three quarters of Earth's land could be characterized this way as being transformed by human activity of one form or another. So it's the majority. Urban areas are actually not very extensive globally. 1-2% of Earth's land could be considered to be urban in the form of urban settlements. But everyone moving into these very dense settlements away from areas that are less densely populated, this concentration of people into cities is basically leading to a pretty massive recovery of woodlands in large areas of the world. And you can – I don't know if you have that here in Oklahoma. I haven't studied it here specifically. But in the Northeast, for example, we have huge areas of regrowth forest in areas that were agriculture 100 years before. And this is common also in places like China and Europe. You have more recovery of woodlands and other less disturbed types of vegetation as a result of urbanization. So some people think of urbanization as kind of consuming everything across the surface of the earth. But in fact, it's actually in some ways the opposite.
Because it's moved people off of that rural landscape and into cities so that rural landscapes can regenerate, I guess is what you're saying. The regrowth that occurs in that area.
More or less. I mean, the one complicating factor that's really important is how the farming system responds to that. When you have this low labor intensity farming, you're basically talking about large scale industrial agriculture. And generally, in those kinds of farming systems, nobody's interested in the marginal land. They only want to use the most productive land because there's a lot of investment in every acre of land. And so for that reason, any kind of marginal lands, you know, less ideal for agriculture, just get abandoned. And those are the areas that are recovering. And like I said, they don't always recover in ways, you know, you don't necessarily get back, you know, a beautiful, pristine forest. You often get a very different kind of woodland, maybe all exotic species or very dominated by exotics, that is not necessarily the ideal.
My guest is Earl Ellis, an ecologist who studies the Anthropocene and how humans affect ecological landscapes. More of our conversation right after a break. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking with Earl Ellis, an ecologist at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. When we left off, he described how the mass migration into urban areas can help land recover, even if it's not necessarily an ideal landscape. So based on that, then, I'm just curious, is the suggestion that we should be working more closely together as humans and to understand how we're having an impact on our landscape and alter our thinking so that we understand that these two things come together? They aren't separable. You can't separate humans from the environment. Or is the goal to, you know, try to do our best to have humans make as little impact as possible on their environment? Which is it?
Yeah, well, that's a lot of questions there. And I don't know if I 100% characterize myself as an environmental advocate. I think I am very interested in communicating what I've learned scientifically about the way that ecosystems have been changing and how humans are changing them and what the consequences are for humans and for non-human species and ecologies. I'm very interested in communicating that. I think one very simple message that maybe is nothing new is the idea that we do profoundly alter pretty much all of Earth's ecology now. And we do that whether we choose to do it intentionally or whether we don't. It's simply a matter of being alive as a human being on Earth right now. We affect the ecology of the planet. And I like the idea that by engaging in that activity more intentionally, now that we know we're engaging, let's be more cognizant of how we might make that engagement more positive for both for humanity and for non-human species. In many cases, we just don't pay attention to the consequences, and then it's not a surprise that the consequences aren't what we want in the end. And I think the good news is that when we really do focus more on the outcomes, we are able to essentially get the same needs met that we need to meet, but with consequences to other aspects of the landscape or ecosystems that are maybe much more positive. It's not inevitable that to use nature, we must destroy it.
So it's not necessarily a matter of, you know, humans should just stop messing with the environment, but that we should understand how we're messing with the environment or how we have an impact on the environment so we can minimize the negative consequences. But it's not a matter of eliminating.
Oh, absolutely not.
Negative consequences, but minimizing them.
I mean, I think there's no possibility of eliminating human consequences. And so I see it as guiding human decisions. And it's a lot of different decisions that get made, many different scales, many different people in the game. But focusing on what are the positive outcomes that we really want to see and how can we engage in making those things actually come true rather than just trying to stop bad humans from destroying the fragile nature. I think that model isn't realistic and it doesn't really lead toward the outcomes that we want.
So other work that you're doing, also very interesting, you've looked at the long-term changes in nitrogen balance in village ecosystems in China and changes in the biogeochemistry of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, those sorts of things in the landscapes in China. So what is it that you've learned in China? I mean, well, first of all, why China? Why look at these things there? And what is it that you've learned there that's helpful to our understanding of the anthropogenic landscape more globally?
Well, I first ended up working in China because I was interested in understanding the ecology of agricultural systems that had been productive and sustained populations for thousands of years. In a sense, what does the ecology of sustainable agriculture look like by studying, you know, real ecologies? And the problem that I focused on in sustaining long-term productivity was the nitrogen limitations, which are endemic to pretty much all terrestrial ecosystems are nitrogen limited. And agriculture probably the most because they're getting the most plant materials removed from them. So nitrogen needs to be put in to these systems to keep them productive. So how do they manage to do this? And I learned that part of it was extremely hard work recycling whatever they could. But even that isn't enough. They were actually, first of all, in a naturally subsidized place, being in a river floodplain, they were getting inputs of nitrogen from sediments that they actually made the use of. They actually dug them out of the canals and put them on the land. And they even purchased inputs of nitrogen from soybean cake that was pressed from places from other areas. They purchased human manure from cities. It was remarkable. They did everything they possibly could to bring nitrogen. They used nitrogen-fixing green manures, just plants grown just for fertilizer that fixed nitrogen naturally. So they did all these things. But the bottom line is they still had a nitrogen-limited agriculture, pretty profoundly nitrogen-limited. And the other thing I found was that they had stopped doing all those traditional things because they now had synthetic nitrogen. And so with the advent of synthetic nitrogen, you know, their whole relationship with all those resources that they were using changed because it was so much easier to use synthetic nitrogen. Their yields went up by about 2 to 4 times.
So you mean chemical-based fertilizers?
That's correct.
Synthetic
urea or ammonium bicarbonate.
That you would just, you know, sprinkle across the ground.
That's right. And, you know, it was liberating for people who had to do some of the hardest physical labor you'll ever imagine. You know, carrying sediments around in buckets out of canals, you can imagine, without, you know, any mechanical help. It's incredible hard work. And so, yeah, they were very satisfied with the new system, but it was completely changing their ecology. And that's where I got interested in the long-term global changes caused by changes like the availability of chemical fertilizer. How does that affect the rest of the planet? And it does. You know, you see big changes in soils, crop yields, populations. All these things change when you change the nitrogen cycle.
So ultimately then, looking at how we use our land and how, you know, whether we do it, I guess, organically or the ways in which we grow our crops, the day-to-day interaction that we have with our environment as humans has led you and others to understand, you know, I don't know, for lack of a better term, the kind of the geologic chronological term, I guess, that we're coming to some new era. Are we in a new era that's some call it Anthropocene, something that is, you know, a whole different way of thinking about human and geological history, right? Can you tell us in the last minute that we have, I mean, what would the next stage be? It seems like that would be the end, right? That human environmental interaction, that's it.
Well, in a nutshell, this concept that by transforming many of Earth's systems, and the one that gets the most attention, and maybe it should, is the climate system being transformed by emissions of greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels. But it's been also transformed by use of synthetic fertilizer. Now, humans synthesize more nitrogen than all of the natural systems on Earth. We actually have changed the nitrogen cycle more than we've changed the carbon cycle. And there's a just a host of other things we've transformed about the Earth system. The idea that as a result of this huge transformation of the Earth system that we now have pushed the planet into a new geological time period, the Anthropocene, a new geological epoch characterized by human transformation of the Earth system, as a new paradigm for looking at the human role on the planet and essentially what the prospects are. And there are many ways of looking at that. Some view it as, like you said, the end of times, the apocalypse, because now we've changed everything permanently. But I look at it from the geological point of view that epochs are very long periods of time, and we're likely to be here for thousands of years. This is maybe just the beginning of the Anthropocene. And that's the way I like to think about it. And it's not to say that everything we've done so far has been an improvement or to our own benefit or to the benefit of the planet, but the idea that it's a long-term process and that we're going to be actively engaged in it for at least the foreseeable future.
Well, sounds very interesting. Earl Ellis, thank you for sharing this with us, and we'll have a lot more to talk about, it seems to me, in the future.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with Earl Ellis, an ecologist at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We have a link to his research on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU through a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview. Next week, we'll continue broadcasting from overseas, but we'll move on to the city of Dubai. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.